Once again, sir, explain why your automobile company needs $25 billion.
Please! I need the money! Please! I swear I'll be profitable! I'll make hybrid cars! I'll make electric cars! I don't want to go bankrupt! Please! Please!
Sir, control yourself! Order! Order!
I'll throw in a free low jack! Oil changes for life! Pinstriping! Please!
Order in the chamber! Order!
This is General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner. Well, I guess Congress isn't going to give us the $25 billion bailout. So I was thinking, while downing cocktails, flying in the corporate jet back to Detroit, why not ask our loyal customers for help? So if you would, go through all the seat cushions in your GM vehicle and gather up whatever change you might find there. Also, check under your floor mats. Anything in the ashtray? What about those side pockets in the door? There's always something in there. Take it all and send it in to us. That way, GM can continue the tradition of making cars you don't want to buy. Thank you.
You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
Time for another page from the Backtime Book of Records as we look at records of all kinds that made the history of November 21st. In 1877, Thomas Edison announced the invention of his phonograph, which led to the phonograph record, which led to radio, which led to us getting fired a lot. It was 1980 when a record 83 million people watched Dallas to find out that Kristen shot JR. And today in 1983, the video for what was arguably Michael Jackson's best record, Thriller, premiered in Los Angeles. That's Back Time for November 21st. This is your announcer speaking.
It's Vinny Penn with your 760, the past 7 days in 60 seconds. Michael Jackson is being sued by an Arab sheik who is also an amateur songwriter who says he was misled by Jackson. Jacko probably feels misled as well, thinking the word amateur meant the sheik was a 12-year-old. His purpleness, Prince, is going door-to-door as a Jehovah's Witness. How long before he changes it to Witness formerly known as Jehovah? Word is Paris Hilton and Benji Madden have broken up. Benji said the couple needed some time apart, and Paris said she needed a new premise for another reality show. And the idiots of the week, the CEOs of the big three automakers who flew private jets to Washington to beg Congress for $25 billion. I haven't seen anything that stupid since the CEOs of the big three automakers flew private jets to Washington to beg Congress for $25 billion. I'm Vinny Penn, and that was your 760.
Jews can now eat ham. It's the Onion Radio News. I'm Doyle Redland. Ending their 6-millennia ban on the consumption of cloven-hoofed beasts, the World Rabbinical Council announced today that Jews worldwide may dig into the delicious taste of ham. Council President David Feinberg.
From now on, during the Passover Seder, which commemorates our people's deliverance from slavery in Egypt, we will remember the day by drinking a tall glass of milk with a thick slice of honey-glazed ham.
Feinberg noted that on the third Saturday of every month, Jews will now eat tons of ham. The new holiday will be called Hamover. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News, online at theonion.com.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Supermarket Deli Worker.
Mr. Supermarket Deli Worker.
Some are content to stock shelves. Others, merely cashiers. But you, sir, operate the most dangerous machine known to man, the meat slicer.
There's a finger in my olive loaf.
When we ask for a pound of pastrami, Mr. Supermarket Deli Worker, you plop down a pound and a half and say, is a little over okay?
Only if I could pay you a little under.
And no one cuts the cheese quite like you.
That cheddar's really sharp, yeah.
So the next time you're holding number 67 and they're calling out number 23, wave your salami and salute to the man who's number one. Mr. Supermarket Deli Worker, a real American hero.
Mr. Supermarket Deli Worker.
Your hairnet just fell into the coleslaw. Now, from high atop the LA Talk Radio building, it's time for Sam and Susie in the Morning.
Sam and Susie in the Morning.
Right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Friday, November 21st. And we're back in the studio live.
Thank goodness it's Friday.
And thank goodness. And you look a lot better today.
Thank you.
I'm sure you didn't look very good yesterday.
I don't know. I'm sorry for calling and canceling in the morning, but I seriously woke up at like 7:30 and my eyes were just like shut.
Really?
And I tried to even look at the phone to call you, and I could barely like pry my eyes open. And I was like, you know what? I was like, there's no way I can go in and like have anything to say.
Why, did you have a wild night previously?
It actually wasn't really that wild. I mean, I had class until 10, you know, usual same old bullshit.
Right.
But then...
And then the group, the study group again?
No.
With the wine and
no,
shit?
No, no. We had den dinner, which is... Every other Wednesday, well, pretty much every Wednesday, our bike group gets together and they have pretty much like a drunken stoned party festival thing. And then it alternates with bike movie night or bike dinner night.
Right.
So, and dinner night is always hosted at someone else's house. But so Eric, my ex, you remember him, he's house sitting at this gorgeous house in Venice. Mm-hmm. And basically, this house is so unbelievable. It has three Picassos.
Really?
Real Picassos.
And they allowed him to throw a party there?
Well, they're out of town. He's house sitting.
Yeah, I know. Fuck, you know. I mean, he could get sued big time.
No, he wouldn't. They're really good, very close friends of his.
Are they? Okay.
So they wouldn't mind.
They wouldn't mind. Okay.
Like, I don't know if they would. If I should say they wouldn't mind, considering the bike. You know, the bike crowd kind of looks like riffraff.
I'm sure.
A little bit.
And how many people do you think were there?
And not that many. Probably like 20.
That's a lot of people to bring inside a house that's not yours.
I left early. I left at about midnight anyway. You know, I only stayed for a couple glasses of wine. You know, it's always fun when you have two of your boyfriends in the same room. Because I had the Franz there and I had Eric as well.
Yeah, so, and they don't like each other.
Actually, they don't really mind each other. They get along pretty well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just on a friendship / bike level.
Oh, I see. But, I thought Franz didn't like him.
Well,
Eric didn't think he did, so.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't want to get into the details of that.
Okay. No, I want to dig into... No, I'm kidding.
Back off, man. Back off. But yeah, so I really wasn't out that late. I was home in bed by like 12:30, and for some reason, I was just so like dragging the entire day.
Really?
But,
yeah.
But anyway, I want to tell you that I am on 4 days of sobriety.
Wow.
Starting with last night.
But wait a minute. You said you just said you had two drinks.
That was Wednesday.
Oh, that was
Wednesday.
The previous night.
Last night was my first sober night.
Okay.
Yes.
So how are you 3 days sober?
No, I'm going into 4 days of sobriety.
Oh, I see.
Do you want to know why?
Oh, okay. Okay, so it's planned to be only 4 days.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
Why?
And last night was my first night.
Okay.
Because I figured it was a sign. After after we had that author in here the other day on the fat belly... flat belly diet.
Yeah.
Not the fat belly diet. Shit. I think everyone in America is on the fat belly diet.
Yeah.
I figured it was a sign and I really needed to go and like be on that diet. So as soon as I left the studio on Wednesday, I went and I bought all of the food that I needed for the 4 day detox. so I'm officially on the flat belly diet.
Really?
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That should actually work. So, so you got the book, and how do you decide what dishes to use to make?
Well, the first 4 days, you're on kind of like a detox diet. You're not supposed to drink for the 4 days, and you're supposed to eat exactly what they tell you to do.
I see.
Like this morning, I had exactly one cup of Rice Krispie Treats, half a cup of unsweetened applesauce, and a third of a cup of unsweetened, unsalted sunflower seeds.
Oh. Well, that's not a bad breakfast.
No, it's just a little bland.
You get Rice Krispies and shit.
Yeah, I usually like have like, you know, cereal, and then I'll throw like a ton of fresh fruit in there,
right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Or have like a little bit of something sweet with it, but everything is like unsalted, unsweetened, just very, very, very bland.
Really, very bland.
Yes.
Wow.
You
know what? Every food that's good for you doesn't taste good. You know, it seems.
You just have to reacclimate yourself to it because, I mean, we're so used to just pouring like a ton of salt or a ton of this, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just to kind of make everything taste good. I kind of grew up on a very bland diet like this, so I was used to it for a million years, and then one day, like someone introduced me to like salt and sugar and fat, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
I was given that stuff from day one. Shit. I need salt on everything and sugar and everything and... Yeah.
Well,
so I'm not eating healthy. But listen, I salute you for the commitment.
It was hard yesterday, I'll tell you that.
Really?
Well, my breakfast, I woke up at noon. Thank you for letting me sleep in. My breakfast was fine, and then my lunch was fine, because I had to go nanny yesterday for about 11 hours. And so when you're nannying and you're babysitting in the middle of nowhere and you've got two kids running around, all you want to do is eat.
I suppose.
It's like you get a little bit bored. It's like, oh, what's in the pantry? Oh, cookies? Oh, cake. Okay, oh, I'll have some of this. But so that was probably the hardest thing, yeah. Was being around the kids, and especially not drinking around the kids.
Yeah. So is the food pretty? I mean, it's not terrible food, right?
No,
it's just that it's bland.
It doesn't taste like much. But I think that's just for the first 4 days, and then I've got to. That's kind of like to shock my system into having smaller portions.
Yeah.
And not having like a salty diet.
Yeah.
But then come Monday night, I will be able to start having my wine again.
Oh, I see.
So we shall see if I make it that far, Sammy.
Yeah, and with a weekend in the middle.
I know, yeah. I know. And what a weekend I have planned.
Really? Well, I have a feeling that you're going to decide, you know what, I'll postpone it till Monday, and you'll start over on Monday.
I can't afford to postpone it till Monday. I already bought all the food. I've already done all the preparations. So at least the food portion, you know, I'm going to stick to for the weekend.
Okay.
But can I tell you what I'm doing tonight?
Of course.
Yeah. So I got a phone call yesterday from one of the kids in my biology class. I shouldn't call him a kid. He's my age. He's 26.
Yeah. Kids. Okay.
I don't know. I just think of anyone who's in school, you're a kid.
Yeah.
But he invited me to be his date to a penthouse party tonight.
Sounds interesting.
I know. And I think it might have something to do with like what Daisy Marie, our former guest,
really?
Was talking about, like, you know, starting in December, you know, everyone's trying to get their vote out for who's going to be the penthouse pet of the year.
Exactly, yeah.
But so this is a big penthouse party in Hollywood. I forget the name of the club where it is. But I'm going to be there tonight as my friend Lane's date.
Oh, wow, Susie.
Yes.
So you're going to have a lot of stories for us.
Hopefully.
Or it's just going to be really lame.
I could go either way.
Yeah.
Really could.
I know. No, it should be fun. It'll probably be fun.
But I swear the only reason this kid asked me to be his date was because here in biology class on Wednesday, class got a little bit boring.
Uh-huh.
And so I decided to jump onto the lab table and start doing like a strip tease to I touch myself.
I can't fucking believe you do this shit in the middle of the lab.
In the middle of the lab. We're like dissecting flowers and like, you know, trying to figure out if this is an angiosperm or a blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And obviously you don't care what people think. Like, she's crazy, she's immature, she's childish.
You know what? That's the farthest thing from anyone's mind when they see me do these things. They're like, thank God we have some live entertainment because this shit's boring.
True. That's true.
And everyone in the class just comes to expect it from me. Like, if I seriously sit there and I'm, like, quietly and diligently doing my homework or, you know, paying attention, then people are just like, hello, Susie, could you please liven things up a little bit? What the fuck?
Were you always like this in school?
No, I think it's gotten a lot worse.
Really?
Yes. I actually used to be very... I used to hate anyone who was like me in school. You know what I mean? Because I would go to class and I would always want to learn. Even when I was a little girl, I was very studious whenever I was in school.
Yeah.
I really think it's just been over the past, I don't know, year and a half that I've really just gotten out of control. So, I don't know. My professor particularly liked it when at the one part of the song, like I'm standing on the lab table and he's like, oh my God, Susie. And I get to the part, it's like, I get down on my knees, I do anything for you. And I literally, like, drop to my knees with, like, you know, the microscope in between my legs, and I'm, like, grabbing it like it's a phallic something.
Oh, man, that professor must fucking go crazy.
He absolutely loves me,
really?
I must say. I really have
really?
To say. Yes.
That's nice.
To the point of, I told you...
So he's easygoing. I mean, you know, he's not like...
He's really easygoing. I'm actually trying to find someone out there in the world who will break my statistics professor's knees. So if there's anyone out there that wants to do that, you know, we can arrange a fee. I don't know.
Oh, well, maybe we can ask the caller that's coming in. Let's see. Good morning. This is Sam and Susie, and you're on the air.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Susie.
Hello.
Hi.
It's your favorite pair of boobs calling.
Hi, Chase. How are you?
Chase. Yeah.
I love that I can say that to you, and you know exactly who I am.
I know. I wasn't sure, but because we've had quite a few nice tits.
No, hers are my favorite of all time.
I know, but she didn't really try to show them off or anything, you know?
I know.
So I
that's the point. I'm demure. I'm saving them for my boyfriend, Sam.
Yeah, no, but no, I didn't say you have to pull your shirt off. But what I'm saying is, at
wear
least
something
you should,
tight. You know, yeah, where we can so get we some can profile, some maybe some. If your nipples are hard, we get some areola side boob.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. You know, I think I'm saving it. Sorry, guys. So, Susie, I was listening to you talk about your class.
Yes. It's very, very studious.
Your lab table dancing?
Yes.
Did you take anything off?
I took off a couple layers, yes.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, by the way, I think Susie's much prettier than her picture on the website.
Okay, well, I asked her to take another picture.
Well, I think we should take one together, Sam.
Yeah, that's true too, huh? Well, I'm actually thinking of getting a headshot, you know, for the website and our wall here.
Yeah.
So maybe we can do it together.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be cool. So that'll then it'd be like similar pictures.
Perfect, perfect.
Yeah. Cool. All right. And Chase, listen, when are you coming in next? I mean, I love
to
look at you.
I was trying to come in this morning. I have so much to talk to you people about. Yeah. But
you people?
Probably not till,
you're talking
well,
about Jews and sluts?
What?
Nothing.
What did you say?
You said you people.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, you people.
Yeah, she's, well, she's on another plane altogether. She's looking down on us.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, right? You see, that's funny. I wasn't thinking of that at all. I was just thinking, like, you guys are, you know, saved in the radio booth.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know? Whereas I'm still walking around amongst the masses.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Chase, are you at home now? Chase, are you home?
I'm home.
What are you wearing? Are you like naked?
Oh, dear. You don't want to know what I'm wearing, Sam. It would bore you terribly.
Really? Well, take something off and then tell us.
You want me to make something up? I probably won't, because actually I was going to talk to you about my work in education, you know, the next time I come in.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would require you not to objectify my anatomy.
Okay. I'll try to do that, you know. But I'm not objectifying it. I mean, I'm admiring it. What's wrong with that, you know? Why do some people feel that, okay, if you tell me something physically, then it's not a good thing, you know?
Sam, you know what? I do.
We've suffered enough trauma. You know, as a teenager, I suffered a lot of trauma from chicks not wanting to talk about sex, you know, rejecting me for my horniness.
How is that trauma? That's repression.
What?
I think that's called being a teenage boy.
Yeah. You get a lot of rejection and a lot of frustration.
And look at you now, Sam.
Yeah.
You know what you guys should have on the air? You should have Aaron. You should have my ex-boyfriend on the air.
Why is that?
Because Aaron would talk to you. He would totally commiserate with you, and now he's, like, doing really, really, really well on his job, and I think he gets a lot of girls.
What is
a lot of girls.
What does he do for work again? I forget.
He's the senior director of A&R at Atlantic Records.
Okay.
Okay.
He's I guess when you're in that industry, you get a lot of chicks.
Yeah.
But I didn't find him attractive at all. You know, I think you have pretty bad taste in men, to be honest, Chase. Almost as bad as mine.
Except for the current one, right?
Yes, the current one was kind of cute.
The current one's pretty awesome. I'm so psyched.
Although, Sam, I do have to tell you, Chase sent me a message the other day being like, I'm sick. Can you bring me soup? I'm sick. And I was like, fine. So, you know, I was really busy all day, and I didn't have time, and I knew her boyfriend was coming into town, and I know she always leaves her door unlocked, and so I brought it over, like, really late, last minute, and they're totally in the bedroom fucking.
Really?
And I hear, oh, baby, oh, and then I'm like, Chase, and then I hear, you were too, and then, like, there are candles lit everywhere, and then all of a sudden, there's silence.
Oh, my God, you're so exaggerating.
I am so not exaggerating. Yeah.
You see, Chase,
exaggerating.
She tries to come across as innocent, but she's not.
Mm-hmm.
She's not at all.
Mm-hmm. You know? Her mouth was rather full when I walked in the door.
I'm
That's
sure
what she
was.
Oh, my God. Be quiet.
All right. Okay. Well, Chase, listen, we got to move along. Was there anything?
Would you kick me off the air, please?
No, listen, not about education, but you wanted to talk to us about psychics the other day. You know?
I did.
But can you hold on just a second? Because first of all, I wanted to let everyone know that at 10 o'clock, we're going to have a pair of, I think, incredible men. One is Howard Rosenberg, and he was the the TV critic for the LA Times, Susie, for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The guy is a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I think, and we're going to talk about the media and everything. And I think they're going to find our radio station pretty interesting. And along with him comes Charles Feldman, who is an investigative reporter, worked for CNN and many other media outlets. And we're going to have actually three Jews and a shiksa in here. Three Jews that totally control the media.
So, oh, fabulous.
So I wanted that. And also, Susie, we have a new host. Her name is Lady J, and she's okay. got an awesome show on Saturday. And she wrote this. She says, "Hello, Susie. Good luck at the penthouse party."
Ooh.
Especially since you're not going to...
appropriate, I think.
Yeah, I'm surprised you're not wearing a black dress, because isn't that what all women wear? It's all you ever see is black dresses.
I don't wear what all women wear, Sam.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I'm not.
But it's dark blue. Thinking? It's close.
I'm not your typical everyday woman here.
I guess not, yeah.
All right, you two. I'll let you hash it out between the two of you.
Wait, no. We wanted to talk to you about psychics.
Yeah, so what were you going to say about psychics the other day?
Let's talk about psychics.
Yeah. Okay, so we were saying that neither Susie or I really subscribe to there being psychics. I happen to think that many of them are sort of condescending, feeling as though they have some superpowers, and they talk down to us, you know? And
they talk down to you? Oh, my God. Yeah. Does someone make you feel bad?
fuck you, Chase, okay? No, I'm just saying that sometimes they rub me the wrong way. But again, you know, we can't make generalizations.
Yeah, that's not a psychic, honey.
Like your boxers?
What? Fuck that. Okay, don't talk about my boxers now. All right. But no, but I think that many times, you know, I just feel like, you know, they don't like that people are skeptical of them, and yet they come and make statements.
If you go to an intuitive who doesn't make room for your doubt, I urge you to not listen to them, because, first of all, for somebody to sit here and tell you that they know your future is kind of nuts. They don't know your future.
No.
You know, my experience of women who have, incredible intuition, incredible intuition. I mean, healers even who can look at somebody's body and go, "Oh, you have a tumor there," and will have it backed up by tests, and then they can do energy work and actually heal the thing. You know, those types of people, are not ever going to, you know, make you feel bad for having, you know, any kind of doubt in what their, you know, their abilities are or what they supposedly see. And if any psychic starts telling you, "Oh, it's this or that or blah, blah, blah," you know, this is kind of my thought on it. I think that not just psychics, I think this actually applies to all people. On any sign that you see, I believe in the concept of synchronicity. And I feel like people say things to you at the exact moment, at the exact time, for a specific reason. And I think that that is sort of the way that the universe can speak to you. It's like one other way that it can speak to you. So, for example, if you went to go see a psychic and the psychic says to you, "Oh, your boyfriend, he's a great guy, but he's cheated on you. You should know this before you get married." You know, I don't know that he's necessarily cheated on you, but maybe one thing that she's picking up or even addressing is that you need to kind of work, you know, look at that possible fear that you have. Or maybe it has absolutely no resonance for you whatsoever, in which case you're either in denial of the fear or it just has no resonance for you.
Yeah, but you know, my question is this, you know, they claim that, you know,
that could ruin your relationship if he's not cheating on you. And I don't know, she's just making something up because she has nothing else to say.
Well either
that. Think there's something wrong if you put more stock in what a psychic says than what your boyfriend says? And if she says, if I walked up to you and said, "Suze, you know something? I saw a vision. You, Susie, are going to become a taxidermist." And while I know that you are, you know, very interested in taxidermy for the purposes of saving Africans, there's a story behind that, so please don't take that out of context.
Move it along, Chase. I mean, you're dragging
along. She's not going to go, "Oh my God, I'm going to be a taxidermist." It's just not... Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Not only that, but let me tell you what the problem is. Okay, is not only do they sort of tell you what they see, but they also dispense advice. And to me, it's like, you're not a therapist. What really certifies you to dispense advice like this for people? You know, I mean, how is there a connection between what you can see and what you know is good for that person?
Well, I'll say this. When I get an intuitive hit on a client that I'm working with...
So you're saying that you're psychic?
I wouldn't say I'm psychic. I would say I'm intuitive.
Okay.
But you were saying that psychics are, you know, they're very, 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 very hyper-intuitive. So if you're intuitive, therefore you are psychic?
It's a little bit different. See, there's one. It's one thing to have intuition on somebody, like, oh, you get like a funny feeling about them, or you really, really like them, or you feel very drawn to them, in which case you get a good vibe off of them. That's an intuition.
Mm.
But then there's certain people whose intuition and psi abilities work in a way where, you know, they will be empathetic. So, for example, if they're around somebody whose heart hurts, then their heart will start hurting, and they will essentially mimic the sensation of the person that they're around. That's another type of psi ability. You know, there's a lot of different types of intuition, so you can't just peg it as one.
Okay.
Some people get visions, and those visions are either So those visions can either be interpreted as dreams, or some people mistake them as exact realities. And sometimes they are precognitions. Who am I to say that they don't exist?
All right. Okay, Chase.
Okay. Sorry, we're having technical difficulties.
You lost us somewhere along the line here. But listen, can you, like, tell what I'm thinking about right now? I mean, do you have any connection with me?
No, Sam, but I could guess.
Oh, sex.
Yeah, like she knows me.
No. Let me guess.
Actually,
sex.
I'm not. Hey, you know, I'm not a one-track mind type of a person.
Basically, everything that you tell me or that I know about you so far leads me to think that you are.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
That you're always thinking about sex. That's why you have to wear whitey tighties because your penis. You've got to keep the monster.
Okay, there is no monster. Okay, but no, what I'm trying to say is, we get a lot of different kind of topics in here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking issue with that. You know,
but there actually
don't try
are
to paint
people
me.
Who would be able to say, call you Sam and get like a little bit of information about you and mm-hmm. have a conversation. Like if you were to talk to me about a given situation in your life.
Right.
And you wanted my intuitive hunch on it, I could offer you that, but you'd have to talk about a situation. It's not like...
Right, right.
It's not something... And I think a lot of people could do that. You know, there's a training to it, you know, when you learn...
So there is a training. That was my other question. Is there a school to go to be a psychic?
There actually is a school in Santa Monica that you can go to be a psychic.
Of course it's in Santa Monica.
Yeah, where else? It's not right on Venice Boardwalk.
it's taught by this man who has a cardboard sign or something.
Yeah, sounds like it, yeah.
Wait, is it really?
No.
Oh.
All right. Okay, Chase.
I love you, Susie.
Yeah, we love you too, Chase. Anyway, keep smiling. Oh, you said Susie. Okay. Well, okay.
All right, Chase. I will pick you up at 12:30 to bring you to the airport.
I'm so excited.
Okay.
Are you going to have your baby with you?
No, no babies today.
Where the hell are you going to?
Where am I? I'm going to Arizona to see my boyfriend for 10 whole days. I'm so excited.
Oh, wow. Sounds
I
good.
Just had a psychic vision of you and your boyfriend, but I'm not going to tell it over the air.
Oh, okay.
Okay, you'll tell me in the car ride down.
Yeah. I don't know if you want me to tell you.
I'm pretty sure I do.
Oh, no, I don't know.
Why don't you tell me?
I just had a vision of you guys getting in a fight.
Getting in a fight?
Yes.
You know what? I was actually thinking that's probably one of the best things that could happen.
Are you kidding?
We've been dating for 4.5 months. We haven't fought once.
I know you haven't, and then that's because you guys have only spent like 2 or 3 days at a time
together.
Yeah, I mean,
what the fuck?
And all of a sudden, you guys are going to be forced into 10 days. Shut up! You're going to be forced into spending 10 days together. You know, you're not going to have like really much of a vacation from each other, and so I could just see something, you know, that hasn't previously come to the surface, coming to the surface, and that is my psychic vision, my woman's intuition, my Susie to Chase.
Yeah.
Vision for the day.
Susie, let's see. I hope you're right. Seriously, because I want to know more about him, and if for any reason I should know something that I don't already know, then thank the Lord. That would make a lot of clarity. Make for a lot of clarity, I guess.
It just makes absolutely no sense to me to have a boyfriend in another friggin' state, you know? It's like, you know what it's like? It's like working downtown and having to commute all the way from Canyon Country or something, you know? It's like, why would you want to? You can have someone...
Because the men that I meet in the city, Sam, are overwhelmingly underwhelming.
Well, you know what?
I agree.
That's
really
a generalization.
No, I'm having the same fucking problem, Sam, and I'm on every dating site in the fucking world right now.
I'm not on any dating site.
That's because you have a man.
But, I mean, there's so many men in this town. How can he possibly generalize?
Well, you know what, Sam?
You know what? There are great ones out there, I'm sure, because I have a number of girlfriends who are very happily married, but I just haven't found them.
Yeah. Okay. So this is like sort of a...
Some of the guys that I'm considering going out with live in Colorado.
Oh, very interesting. Okay. You guys really want to complicate your lives. Well, the people
really
I guessed,
no. No. You know what, Sam? This guy just seems that great. I couldn't resist.
Wonderful. Well, awesome. I'm really happy for you. I mean, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's not sort of like a quote-unquote a normal relationship. And, you know,
what is a normal relationship?
Susie? No, that's not normal. Normal is, you know, I mean, you spend a lot of time together. You can see each other. If you go home and you feel like, you know, I want to go out to dinner with someone, or I just want to be with someone, you can just call and you're there, or they're there, you know. And here it's sort of like you have to do everything by phone and email, and it's just not natural.
That's just kind of the course that this world has taken, though.
No, I mean, that's by choice, you know. I mean, I had a girlfriend in Toronto for about a year, and finally I got tired of it. I said, this is not what I want.
That's because you're very Instagram gratification oriented and you want it now.
Is that what you think?
I do.
Okay, gee, you're really beating me up today.
No, that's not a bad thing.
No.
I'm the same way. Like, if I want something, I want it now, and I have to get it right now.
No, but that's not the point. The point is, I felt that we were talking too much on the phone, and when you do, when you can't, like, just hug someone and sit next to them and just be quiet, on the phone you constantly have to talk, so you start saying shit after a while.
Then you get a vibrator.
Actually, can I tell you something, Sam? That's actually not true, because I have Skype on my computer, as does Chris.
As does Susie.
And we will actually hang out via Skype on the computer. He was really cute. He calls me up on Sunday. He was, like, watching a basketball game or something, and I don't remember what I was doing. But he's like, hey, baby, why don't we just leave Skype on? We can. Oh, I was watching Oprah.
People
like,
actually watch Oprah.
Skype on and hang out.
And Sam, I used to do the same thing with my Canadian boyfriend. We would cook dinner, like, on the phone with each other. He would be in Vancouver, I'd be in Venice, and, like, we're on Skype and we're cooking dinner. I'm wearing just an apron, you know, like, cooking up my whatever. Da 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 da. He gets to see my little ass shaking, and I'm telling you, it really creates some passion when you do see each other. This is the best thing I ever did to surprise a boyfriend. I got off the plane in Vancouver, and I never really wear lingerie because I'm kind of uncomfortable in it.
Yeah.
And I really just don't think of myself as a sexy person, but I bought all of this lingerie, and complete with the thigh highs and the things that, like, connect to the thigh highs, the thingamajig, you know, and, like, the high heels and just everything. Wow. And so I get to the airport, and this was so embarrassing. And so I run into, like, the handicap bathroom stall, and I'm in there, and I'm trying to, like, it must look like a hooker's getting ready when you see, like, the fishnet footed stockings and everything. And I'm, like, on the ground, like, trying to, like, figure out how to snap the thing behind my ass because I can't really do it from where. But anyway, so then I put my trench coat on top of everything else, and I'm just wearing the lingerie and the trench coat. And so I'm walking out of the airport, and all of a sudden I feel everyone, like, start to look at me. And from their perspective, they should only be seeing, you know, stockings,
right,
high heels, and a girl with a trench coat on.
Right.
This trench coat had a split all the way up from the back, all the way up to, like, the middle of the back.
Wow.
And so it was completely just Susie in her lingerie with everything just, like, hanging out every step. It was just completely exposed.
How fucking embarrassing.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, Susie.
That's a story.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. And, I mean, just, oh. But showing up at his house wearing that lingerie and just dropping the trench coat in the doorway after having only had Skype sex for a month.
Right.
My God, Sam.
All right,
dude.
Chase. Listen.
I'm going to go, you too.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling, and have a great time in Arizona. And,
thank you.
Yeah,
I just got all warm and squishy inside thinking about that. Oh.
What?
No, I got warm and squishy thinking about the sex I had with Drew. Oh, man.
With Drew?
The Canadian.
I'll see you soon.
Okay, thank you, Chase.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, Chase, Susie's friend. Calling from, where does she live, Santa Monica or something?
I always forget if it's Brentwood or Westwood.
Oh, okay.
The two always confuse me.
They do.
Yeah.
Well, Brentwood is on one side of the 405 and Westwood is on the other side.
Which one's close to me?
Westwood.
Okay, then it's Westwood.
Yeah.
I'm so freaking bad.
Yes, you are. Okay, let's take a quick break and we'll be back right after this.
Are you a prisoner looking to become a prisoner of love? Then you need the dating site for criminals, eFelony.com.
The first time I saw Snake in the men's exercise yard, I thought he looked sharp. Of course, I was looking through the razor wire.
I felt like Cupid shot an arrow in my heart. Turns out it was an Aryan Nation guy with a shiv and it was my kidney. But it was still special.
At eFelony.com, we match you with other convicts based on 29 counts of parolability. So there's no reason to be single unless you're in solitary.
Now I found the perfect match. I'm ready to make this a life sentence. Along with, you know, my life sentence.
Go to eFelony.com. You'll be in for a little romance no matter what you're in for.
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station, your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
Thank you. Susie in the Morning on LA Talk Radio.
And we're back with you, and our guests are early, which is amazingly nice.
So amazingly nice. Thank you very much for being on time in Los Angeles.
Yes. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good. Try to get just a little bit closer to the mic.
Yeah. No, it's a benefit of scheduling homeless people. We have nowhere else to go. I'm selling oranges at the bottom of a freeway.
We've been parked outside all night.
Really? Well, this is good. Yeah. It was worth it that much, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for coming, and we have Mr. Howard Rosenberg.
Yes.
And I don't know why we can't hear you.
Hold on a second.
Could be me.
Did someone mess up the microphone here?
And you've still got the background music on too, Sammy.
I do, huh? Whoops. Okay.
Well, I'm totally screwing up here, you see, because I'm really excited.
Yes, we've been eagerly anticipating you gentlemen for a long time now.
something fell in my lap.
I'm totally screwed up here.
Okay, hold on. Usually it's me sitting in the guest laps.
This is for real, right? It's not a joke.
No, this is not a joke.
No, we're not pulling your leg here. I mean, we're like really, really not prepared.
Well, no, while you do that, if anyone out there has another quarter for my parking meter, that would be great. just send it in.
I'll tell you what. I'll take a break and go and move your car for you.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
No.
Can you hear me now? Hello. No, it's better.
You've got to talk right into it.
Right. Okay. Well,
just get your face right up and in there.
He doesn't really have to, you know. But I think something's wrong.
Hello, Susie.
I can hear you, baby.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
I need this thing right. You need it because it pops. But if you go this way, I think we're fine. Okay?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
That's better. That's
okay.
Better.
Okay.
So Mr. Howard Rosenberg.
Yes.
And you used to be a TV critic for the LA Times.
Yes, for 25 years.
25 years.
And I now write a monthly column on news media for the LA Times.
Yeah.
You know what? That microphone's not working. It's really not working. I mean, it's really bothers me.
Sorry about this.
Yeah, I mean, we're totally like distracting you. They're like, who are those amateurs, you know?
But if I have something important to say, I'll borrow Charles.
Okay. And Mr. Charles Feldman, of course.
Hello.
And you are an investigative reporter, or how would you describe yourself?
I've spent years doing that for CNN and still do it. Did it in print as well, but also radio and TV, yeah.
Amazing. And you've been doing this for a long time too, right?
Oh, yeah, about 20 years now.
Really?
Yeah. Wow.
So you guys have been in media for a while.
We're really old.
Yeah.
Very old. That's why we have these oxygen tents in front of us.
We go back to the days of kinescopes. Remember those?
Yeah.
That's before my time.
Oh, okay. That's before my time, too. But
yeah, she doesn't remember much. Yeah. But at any rate, so I just wanted to introduce, I mean, we're sitting here, three Jews in media, because we all know we own the media, and we have a shiksa in here as well.
You
know,
right so, here.
Yeah.
You know, Howard, that's a good title for another
three
book.
Three Jews in a shiksa.
Yeah, there you go.
In media.
In media as well.
For a terrible sitcom.
Yeah. Just reinforcing, we own the media, and we say this, you know, we own Hollywood, we own
absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so people are not wrong, you know, they...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The truth has finally.
There you go. You see, we dare to say it.
That's right.
Now, are you guys both Angelinos? Did you grow up here?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn.
I'm a New Yorker too.
Oh, okay. What part?
Kind of all over. My dad's in the city, and my mom's in Dutchess County.
Ah, okay. So. I know all those well, and then I transferred, as we like to say it, from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and I lived there for most of my life until I came out here in '94.
I was born in Kansas City, Missouri.
Uh huh.
And I
there's Jews in Missouri?
Actually, two or three.
Oh, really?
That's right. No.
Now it's minus one.
Okay.
Everybody on each coast can't believe that there are Jews in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
There are lots
including
me.
Yeah. We're pretty much all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place. And so I went to school in various places. And before here, I was in Louisville, Kentucky, where there were also Jews.
Uh huh.
Before that, in Moline, Illinois, also Jews.
That totally blows me away.
Right. And in Los Angeles, no Jews.
No Jews here. No majority
just
yet, anyway.
You guys, you'll have to forgive him. This is probably my fault because I'm always giving him a little bit of heat.
Yeah. Well, what about being Jewish and stuff?
Yeah.
So, Sam, where are you from?
I'm from Israel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So
other Jews
I'm,
there.
Yeah, I'm a real Jew. You know how people like to say, "Oh, you're less Jewish than I am." You know.
Oh God.
So great. So Charles, you worked for CNN for quite a while. Were you like a freelancer or
no?
You worked for them.
Yeah. No, I was. I got an actual paycheck. If you call
you
it.
Did. Wow, that's yeah. awesome. You yeah. know, it's nice. Sometimes
it's nice to get a paycheck. Get, yeah.
This is where we got to know each other. Charles worked for CNN. Part of my beat writing about the media was writing about 24-hour news channels, and I once wrote something about Charles that was nice, and he was so shocked that anybody
really?
Would write something nice about him.
Yeah. Everybody was shocked.
Could not believe it. Yeah. Could not believe it.
So. And that's interesting because, Howard, I know that some people tend to not agree with everything that you say.
Oh, really?
Right? I don't know. This I'm learning all about
this
you.
This is really a shock. I can't believe it.
I guess as a critic, yeah.
Only you would expect. Would, but no. The Jews certainly would.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't agree with anything in the book.
No.
Of course, your book is No Time to Think, yeah. The Menace of Media Speed and the 24-Hour News Cycle.
That's right.
And I found it to be fascinating because you're really dealing with relevant stuff, you know, things that are happening these days. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about, like, the essence of the book, why you wrote it, what is it about?
Well, first of all, let me just preface this by saying neither Charles nor I are against the internet. I mean, we're very much pro-internet, pro-technology.
Right.
You know, it took us almost a year to write this book, and without the internet, it would have taken 2 years. You know, we understand its potential. We're fans of it. We use it all the time.
Right.
What our book is about, the crux of our book, is about irresponsible use, and that involves speed. We feel, and it's not just we feel, it's a truism, it's true, that media are moving so fast today, media, all media, but especially the cable news channels and the internet, that it literally gives all of us no chance to think, that we're making decisions on the spur of the moment,
right.
Gratuitous decisions, instant decisions, and that is a very dangerous situation. It's not that speed has not always been a component of media, it certainly has. Charles and I have been media for years and years, and speed has always been part of what we do.
Right.
But today the stakes are so much higher because media is so much more pervasive, and the technology is so far advanced that it increases the dangers of people making mistakes, not just people like us in the media or people who are down on the pavement. We're talking even national leaders. The more pressure the media puts on them to go faster and faster and faster, the greater the danger that even somebody in a very high up place will make a mistake that could have potentially disastrous results.
Right, right. So you're saying because of that speed, there's a certain amount of carelessness on the part of the media, and they don't report necessarily the truth or the...
Well, you know, we have a quote in the book from a guy named Keith McAllister, who used to be my boss, actually, at one point at CNN. He was in charge of all the national coverage. And I'm paraphrasing his quote, but basically what he said was that all of the errors, the really bad errors in news, tend to come because of speed issues, because people are rushing to either get something to print or something on the air nowadays, you know, on the internet. And I think that there are lots of examples of that. And I think, you know, if you think about it, it's intuitively, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Right.
I mean, if you're going to do something really fast, whether it's putting together a cake in your kitchen or writing a book, you know, the faster you do something, the more you introduce the possibility of error. It just stands to reason.
Because you don't verify your facts.
You don't have time?
No time, right.
Yeah.
And you know, this even applies to 24-hour cable news networks, which go almost exclusively live. Now, you know, I've been a print journalist my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a print journalist, I have layers of editors above me watching out that I don't make mistakes. And still, it's human nature. I still make mistakes.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about live, you say it, and brother, it goes. Okay, there's no safety net, nothing to catch it, and that's incredibly dangerous, and much of cable news, anyway, is live. People talking off the top of their heads.
Yeah.
As much of it truthful, possibly, but also much of it is not truthful. And as Charles just said, that increases the possibility of error.
Right.
And that's, it's so dangerous, especially for someone like me, you know what I mean? Like, I'm still in school, and I'm still trying to, like, figure out where I stand on a lot of different things that are going on in the world and yeah. politics and things. And so, you know, I know I'm very busy. I've got a number of jobs, and I go to school. So when I have a few minutes to turn on the TV and catch the news or turn on the internet, and I'm getting these brief headlines flashed at me, I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, and so I don't like to automatically believe it as a blind truth, but, you know, you can't really help that sometimes. I mean, you hear it, and you're just like, whoa, oh my, really? That's what's happening? That's what's going on?
Because it's coming at you so fast.
Yes,
well,
yes.
Let me ask each of you, I'm just curious, what would you describe as your primary news source?
Probably the internet, right?
The internet.
Yes.
And where on the internet?
CNN. I go to CNN a lot.
CNN. Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly. Okay, Charles and I are out of here right now. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, don't mention the name in here.
I'm blushing.
No, you actually are.
I know.
He has a substitute host on the Radio Factor this morning. I'm here to report. I was really? Just on the way in.
So,
but Barry, are you serious?
I am serious.
Okay. And do you? Okay. This is very interesting. Do you regard O'Reilly as a news person, a place where you can get a straight account of the news?
Yes and no.
Give me the yes.
Oh gosh, I feel like I'm put on the spot now.
give me the no.
I mean, I feel like he does present like issues and things like that, yes. but obviously he's very one-sided with yeah. his presentation of things. Yeah. And then I usually like to form my own opinion after the fact. And if I have time with regards to certain issues, I'll go and research it and try and get a balanced opinion, because I know his is most certainly not balanced, but it's also an entertaining way to get my news for me.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Would you agree that yes. if you use him as a primary news source, there's some danger in that?
Yes, yeah. yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. But you know what? You know, when I think of something like Time Magazine, you yeah. know, gotcha. You take that as a factual...
No, spin. There's
right.
a lot of spin.
Yes, because there's a lot of opinion, yeah. I noticed, in the articles.
Yeah.
So you have to understand that before you start reading the magazine.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with opinion if it's labeled. Opinion.
Yes, that, yes.
That, I mean, that's it, truth in labeling. It's, right. it's when...
Yeah. Wow, that's a nice ring. I like that.
I know.
like they say in movie theaters, will everyone please turn off their cell phones and...
Charles,
and,
I think you're calling me. Are you in trouble here already? Okay, no, get out of here. Yeah, but there is, Time, Newsweek, they certainly have a point of view.
Right.
To me, the magazine, which is a terrific magazine, where you get terrific investigative reporting, which is more or less down the center, is The New Yorker. The New Yorker... I'm not selling subscriptions.
Right.
It is a just terrific magazine.
Mm.
But the important thing is just to know. I mean, if you read Time, for example, and you
right.
realize it has a point of view, then you're okay. You
right.
know, the
right.
problem is when most people don't realize this. And today, we are deluged by so much news, faux news, so-called information, at any given point that it's very hard to remember the source. I mean, 2 weeks later, you may not remember whether you read something in Newsweek or whether you heard it on the Letterman show, or was it Bill, was it Stewart with the Daily Show?
Mm-hmm.
John Stewart.
Yeah. You can't even remember this person.
Yeah.
And that's a danger where you don't remember the source of the information, and the source is really critical.
I believe everything on John Stewart.
Yeah, well, of course. Well, okay, there's another case. Would you consider that a news show? A legitimate news show?
Not really.
Okay.
But you have to know, am I right? You have to know something about the news, or the jokes aren't funny.
Yes, exactly.
Right. That's
true.
Otherwise you
but in 2004...
That's true. It needs to be in context.
Yeah. 2004, the Pew Polling Service, a very reputable organization, okay, polled people and concluded that 24% of people between the ages of 18 and 29 used The Daily Show as a primary news source
really?
About the election.
Really?
Now,
oops.
And no, well, I mean, it's funny, it's great,
yeah.
but even
but
Stewart himself says, you know, this is not news, this is faux news, this is satire.
Right.
But if that many people believe it, it's real news, even if you agree with its point of view.
Danger, yeah. danger.
Yeah. Danger, yeah. danger.
But it's the same thing with Bill O'Reilly, you know, I mean, I don't think he pretends to be objective. His whole show is about opinion.
No.
Right?
I think he'd say he's objective.
Really?
he's very subjective.
Well, he's
yeah.
balanced.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
fair and balanced.
Oh, yeah. Aren't they all on Fox?
Fair and unbalanced.
Oh, goodness.
Okay, we have a phone call. Let's see who it's calling. Good morning. You're on the air with... Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Well, we can't... Lady Green seems ultimately impossible, but how do we determine the truth? I mean, we'll go to the internet and we'll investigate if we question anything, which is like the blind leading the blind almost.
That's a good question. I mean, and we address that in the book, and it comes down to something called media literacy. Mm-hmm. And it's something that in a lot of other countries they do practice, and we cited an example in Canada, for example, and we don't in this country. And by media literacy, it sounds very complicated, but it really is very simple. Mm-hmm. It's taking people from the time they're very young, students, and then as they get older.
Toddlers, even.
Even toddlers. Mm-hmm. And teaching them to evaluate information, to look at information and ask yourself a number of questions. You know, where is this information originating from? Right. Is there an agenda that the person who is putting out this information might have? How do you verify information? How do you sort of check and double check things? And it's not really that complicated, but it's something that we don't do in this country. Mm. And I think to a very bad effect.
You know, there's an educator in Canada named Vivian Basquez, mm-hmm. who does it with use of, listen to this, a McDonald's Happy Meal with kids. Okay, this is how she teaches little kids media literacy. She takes the Happy Meal, she deconstructs everything in the Happy Meal and applies it to media literacy. Here's a hamburger. Where did the hamburger come from? It came from a cow. Where did the cow come from? Et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Yeah, here's the bun. Where did the bun come from? Well, it came from wheat. Where did the wheat come from? It came from a field, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
The packaging. Where did the packaging come from? It came from, paper, forest, et cetera.
The toy, China.
And the toy, China. Exactly. And so in that way, and she does that, and then she makes a big chart on the wall and does the same thing with media. Mm. What is the source of this media? Does this element of media have an agenda? Is it what it seems to be? And it's really a terrific way to teach kids. You use something that they're very familiar with.
Do the hamburgers in McDonald's do they really come from cows?
No.
That's debatable.
That may be a flaw in that teaching
Charles,
technique.
We just had that similar conversation about the chicken McNuggets like a couple weeks ago.
What are they?
Yeah, exactly.
And I really like them, so I didn't want to know.
Yeah, you don't want to find out.
I'm a vegetarian, so I'm out of this.
Yeah, way. There you go. You don't have to worry about it.
All I have to do is smell it.
We should play them our ham little thing that we had before.
Oh, the Jewish thing. Okay,
yes.
We have the Jewish ham.
Yeah. Well,
that's a good product.
There you go. And you guys probably listen to the Onion sometimes, right? Or read it or something.
Yeah, sure.
So it's pretty funny. I'll play this for you. We played it at the top of the show. Check this
Jews
out.
Jews can now eat ham. It's the Onion Radio News. I'm Doyle Redland. Ending their 6-millennia ban on the consumption of cloven-hoofed beasts, the World Rabbinical Council announced today that Jews worldwide may dig into the delicious taste of ham. Council President David Feinberg.
From now on, during the Passover Seder, which commemorates our people's deliverance from slavery in Egypt, we will remember the day by drinking a tall glass of milk with a thick slice of honey-glazed ham.
Feinberg noted that on the third Saturday of every month, Jews will now eat tons of ham. The new holiday will be called Hamover. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio.
Okay, so can I say something to my I say something to my brother, who's a very observant Jew? I had nothing to do with it. No control over that.
Yeah. I know. If it was up to him, we wouldn't mention the word ham.
No.
But so, Lady J, did that answer the question for you?
But as far as CNN goes, and it being the trusted source of news via your motto, and then sometimes I look at BBC and some of the other international news sources, and then I find that not only were we all depicted in a huge light of being the honorable country, saving the world in some sense, but we also don't get the complete information. Why is that? Why is America so jaded when it comes to our news sources and information?
Good question.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't limit it to America, okay? This is a global phenomenon, that of twisting facts to achieve a point of view. But let me ask you something. What is your primary news source, as long as we're doing a little poll here? Where do you get your news?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. Where do you get your news?
CNN.
CNN. Why do you
watch CNN?
Because you believe it's the most trusted news source. You believe
well,
it's
that, and then I also get international newspapers, and I read the newspapers that speak on the same issues, but I get a more real, hands-on type of feel when I read those newspapers versus here, where it's painted in this pretty picture and, you know, it's all politically correct, which sometimes hides the truth, you know, and it's such a, I don't know, I feel like, well, I'm not duped but not given the complete information all the time.
Well, look, I'm sitting next to somebody here who spent 20 years at CNN, okay, so I'm in danger.
The world's most important network.
And I would tell you, for example, would you trust a guy like Anderson Cooper if you knew that he actually was a bookmark? Charles has to tell this story.
Yeah, no, yeah, I mean, you know who Anderson Cooper is, of course, right?
Yes.
The fastest talker on the planet.
Right, uh-huh. And
isn't that Gloria Vanderbilt's son?
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely right. Yes. And so a few weeks ago, I was at an airport, and I picked up a book that I was going to buy at one of the shops, and I open up the book, and there's this sort of 6-inch cardboard cutout of Anderson Cooper staring at me. And if you turn him over, where on a human being you'd have a rear end, right. if you turn it over, there was an advertisement for CNN.
So
here you have CNN's, you know, most trusted anchor, and he's a bookmark. And I was saying to Howard, I mean, if you think back, and not that long ago, I can't imagine, you know, in the days when you had sort of, you know, Tom Brokaw at NBC News, right. or Dan Rather at CBS, or Peter Jennings, yeah. and the late Peter Jennings at ABC, or even now, you know, Brian. Can you imagine Brian Williams at NBC right. as a bookmark?
You're right about that, yeah. Or Walter Cronkite, you know.
You would imagine Colbert as like a bookmark.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Exactly. But I mean, does anyone other than me think that's weird?
It is.
It's a little weird.
Well, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay.
Well, what it really points to also is the celebration of personality in news, okay, where the personality presenting the news becomes at least as large as the news itself.
Yeah,
and that is another
yeah.
dangerous phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. And these anchors become stars in their own
right.
Well,
but that's the strategy. I mean, that has always traditionally been the way the television news has tried to attract viewers.
I see.
Through personalities and anchors.
So they create celebrities.
Even Walter Cronkite. I mean, you know, right. he did not get the big bucks at CBS because he parachuted over Normandy with the troops.
Right.
He got the big bucks because there was something about this guy.
He wandered into my driveway once in Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Walter Cronkite?
Uh-huh.
How did that happen?
Actually, was he drunk? No.
Was he walking when he walked?
He was walking. He was walking with some family members in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I actually lived
right next... This goes in our next book.
No, seriously, he was just walking down to the ocean and I was you know, out walking my dog, and he literally just like wandered into my driveway, and I was like, "You're Walter Cronkite." He's like, "Yes, I am. Hello, young lady." And I was like, "Oh my goodness!" And that was the
and Marblehead is a non-Jewish area, right there.
Yes. Actually, Swamp's got right next door to it. That's where most of the Jews are.
They always find their little areas, right?
They've got their little niche.
Right. By the way, I should
mention we have a chapter in the book for non-Jews too. So
yes,
this
excellent.
Book is not in Hebrew. Come on.
I have a confession too, because I feel badly. The other day I closed my book real hard and I cut Anderson's head off. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
my apologies.
I don't believe that.
I'm kidding.
His head is too big. He couldn't possibly cut it off. Head is like the entire
boys, head. Boys, yeah. I love it.
Terrible. Well, they were going to have a Lou Dobbs one, but it was too big to fit in a book.
That's terrible.
We're
going to
be serious here. It's a serious topic.
Not here, yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Did you guys know what you were getting into?
Yeah.
No, we're actually respecting you. We get a lot worse than this.
Oh,
but
okay.
But anyway.
If anyone gets upset, let them sue Howard.
Yeah.
We don't care.
Well, so do you still work for the LA Times?
I write a monthly column now on news media.
Okay, and before what, you wrote a daily one or a weekly one?
No, okay, give me a break. No, 2 to 3 times a week for 25 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was a television critic, but I had sort of had this love-hate relationship with news. I found it so fascinating, and I did a lot of columns on news media.
Really?
Yeah, because I think it's so important, and you know, in local stations. station, for example, it's the only original programming virtually that they do. These local news stations and these local news shows, which are, I mean, if they weren't so sad, they would just be high comedy.
Aww.
I mean, come on. These people are like, give me a break.
So what's wrong with local news?
I mean, it's not news. How's that for a starter?
Really?
Their main agenda is to promote themselves. That's it. If you look at them closely, everything they do is self-promotional. Mm. And when they do regular news, what kind of news do they do? It's always violence.
Yep.
And these live chases. I mean, if you have two kids chasing each other on skateboards, there's going to be a chopper above you. Live coverage.
Only
of
in
it.
LA, yeah.
Like it's the end of the world. And frequently they do this live coverage. They don't even know what they're chasing. They don't even know what this person in the car is accused of. And it's live and it's dangerous. Let me take you back to 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you recall this. There's this guy being chased on the freeway in a mm-hmm. in a truck, okay?
Was it a white truck?
White, well, no.
That was long before.
This is a different crazy guy. Okay, right. And he's waving his rifle outside the door.
Oh.
Okay, and this goes on for a couple of hours. It creates a terrific, horrible traffic jam in L.A. He finally stops his car on a freeway overpass. And by the way, everybody in L.A., every station that has the capacity to go live is watching this. Two channels, Channel 5 and Channel 11, have interrupted children's programming
really?
To watch this, okay?
Yeah.
And they have this live. This guy stops his truck on a freeway overpass and gets out of the car. The car explodes for some reason. The truck.
I remember that.
Okay, he gets out of the truck, goes back to the truck, go gets his shotgun, and as everybody is coming in for a closer shot, puts it to his head and blows his brains out.
And blows it, yeah, right on live TV.
Live TV. And,
yes.
and everybody was so apologetic. They said, oh my God, we apologize. We had no idea what was going to happen. And that's the point. You don't have any idea with live, and that, again, is the danger.
Mm.
Too fast to think.
I'll tell you something else about local news, because a few years back, many years back now in New York, in between the CNN thing, there was a period when I, for a few months, was hired. I don't even think you know this, Howard.
No, I don't.
I was hired by WABC-TV in New York to write teases. You know what teases are
mm-hmm.
for news? You know, it's like, you know, coming up next,
right.
You know, world ends at 11.
They're good at that. Those
and it never does.
Yeah, but we'll be right back to tell you about that.
And you know what's funny? It's like I always know, I barely watch TV, but sometimes I just walk by it, right?
Right.
And I always know when it's sweeps month, you know?
Uh-huh.
Just by the
sure.
teaser.
Right,
like
and the sweeps, of course,
well,
people don't know it.
Yeah. After Charles finishes the story, let me follow up on that because it's very comedic.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm handed this book, which is sort of the Eyewitness News, and that's what the program is called, of course, Eyewitness News Manual, which they give to their reporters and their staff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written by a guy named Al Primo, who is still with us. And Al Primo is sort of the godfather of
happy talk
news. He was the guy that sort of invented the idea of having, you know, two anchors at the desk, and they would sort of chatter away, much like what we're doing now, but they're doing news.
Right.
You know, and they
important
bring the
stuff.
Exactly. Right, and they have the
nuclear bomb went off today, and listen, Charles, what did
exactly.
you have to do?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And here was the thing that I found very interesting. In reading the manual that they handed out to their new reporters, what it said, I'm paraphrasing, but this is pretty close to it, is it gave the instructions to the reporters that the story, when they went out to cover a story, it wasn't about whatever it was they were covering.
Mm-hmm.
What it was about was their adventures through whatever it was they were covering.
Right.
And that their approach to doing their story was to present it in a way to the public that it wasn't so much the story, it was the reporter's journey through that story.
Sure.
Right.
And that really started us down this road of shifting the focus from where it ought to be, which is whatever the event is that we're covering, to it being now on the person who are covering
right,
and that's
right.
where it really began.
And that's true. They become the news. I mean, you know, we talk about Katie Couric and all this or what's going on, and it's like suddenly we're talking about the people that are supposed to give us the news. They become the news.
Mm-hmm. And the manual directed you to do this or to present it in this fashion.
Yeah, it was a format, and these shows are very formatted. I mean, nothing is done by chance. It's all very well thought out.
Sure.
And that was the formula that had worked worked for Premio had experimented with this in, I believe it was Philadelphia TV, and then he brought the concept to San Francisco and then New York.
Now, Charles, I just want to ask you, why do you think that they are using this format? Why do you think they're choosing to do it this way?
Well, because I think they believe that news has to be sugar-coated, that the public doesn't really have an interest in news, but they do have an interest in personalities. Mm. And if they are watching the personality, they're more likely to watch. And also because there's great competition, remember, mm-hmm. among all these different news stations. And if you're covering, say, a train wreck, right? Well, you know, a train wreck is a train wreck, no matter who covers it. So how do you get the audience to watch your coverage of the train
wreck instead of the other station,
as opposed to the other one? And the way you do that, they think, is by building up whoever it is, the personality,
right,
who is covering it. So you may want to watch.
Well, therefore, don't you think that's a valid way to get people to learn what's going on in the world around them?
Sometimes.
I mean, it's better. You know, I would be watching The Young and the Restless instead of watching what's going on in the train wreck. But yet, say there's a hot guy who's like, you know, doing the news. And I'm like, I didn't want to watch that news. You know, and then therefore subsequently become like a better informed human being.
It's the first time we had a question like that. Yeah, that's right. Hot guy is never
a hot guy, right?
especially in conjunction with us. We're very, very, very cool down the eyes.
Oh, man.
Well,
you guys aren't too bad in the eyes. I'm telling you, we've had much worse in here.
Wait a minute. That's one of those double edged.
Yeah, exactly. Was that a compliment?
Yeah. That's like when someone meets
a compliment.
That's like when someone meets you in the street and they go, "Boy, you look good now."
Yeah. Yeah, for your age, right? Yeah.
Charles, I'm trying to promote our book and you're making jokes. This relates to our book because
your book out for Christmas.
Don't worry. Okay, great.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
You're welcome.
We do, because we talk a lot in the book about phone news, and this relates to phone news. And again, it relates to rating sweeps for your viewers or your listeners who don't know what rating sweeps are. Three times a year, television does what they call rating sweeps, where they measure audiences in detail.
Right.
And during these periods, local news especially really pours it on to get people to watch.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so one of the things they do is, again, emphasize personality. There was one year, mm-hmm. I wrote about this for the LA Times, where they sent Paul Moyer out for Channel 4 News.
Right.
And theoretically, they manufacture these documentaries, mini docs, they call them. It was all this week. Paul Moyer went out to find out what was happening in his former neighborhood. I don't know, it was Altadena. All he had to do was go out there and make a phone call. No. Mm-hmm. Okay, they went out there with cameras, and he knocks on the door. He says, "Remember me? I used to live here." All this, like it was all spontaneous. And the people inside say, "Well, what, Paul, it's you. We had no idea." All this supposed stuff to promote him. But they always had these mini docs with bizarre titles, like, for example, you know, "Breathing, Why We Have to Do It." All this week on the channel. Channel 4 News. Skin, why it's on the outside, not the inside.
Yeah.
Watch this week and we'll tell you.
And it is things like that. I mean, they really, really try to become sensational.
Yeah.
And then you really lose credibility.
And most of these people, I mean, like these anchors, if you set them out to recover a real story, they might fall into a manhole and really injure themselves.
Exactly.
Better not to do it.
There is this one example, by the way, you just remind me of this, which is notorious in the industry. And it was a New York one, but it may have reached even all the way out here in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
But there was a guy named Jerry Nachman, was a sort of legendary, he was a newspaper editor in New York, and he also was a news director. And during one of these sweep periods, he came up with this five-part series, because there had been a number of incidents that year. There was a volcano going off somewhere in the world, there was a plane crash, all kinds of horrible things. So he came up with this series for Sweeps Weeks, and it was called "Is God Punishing Us?"
I love that.
Brilliant. And the critics in New York raised the interesting question that they said, well, you know, it isn't that bad of a concept, except, is he going to have God on for his side?
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Well, I know. And it's like, you know, you're right about that, you know, and I think local news is really guilty of this stuff, you know, and
it's the pits, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I mean, they're even trying to make
first
a big deal out of them.
First of all, it's not in high def.
Depends what channel you're watching.
You just want to watch that hot guy in high def.
Exactly.
That's what you want
to
do.
See the
I resemble
details.
That remark.
Yeah, she wants to seem clearly and sharp.
Right, yeah.
Now, you know what I found interesting is in the beginning of your book, you mentioned that you guys really hatched this whole idea down the street here at Art's Deli.
Down the street.
At Art's Deli.
At Art's Deli.
Susie, have you ever eaten at Art's Deli? It's
no,
right
do
down the street.
Yeah, if you want to write a book, it's a really good place to
And definitely a place to rub elbows with Jews and stuff. Definitely the place
no,
to
No, I do. Love good Jewish delis. It's one thing you know that I grew up to appreciate in New York.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the book could have been.
Don't look for a replication here. New York, nothing's like it in New York.
I know.
And it was a toss-up. Bagels. The book could have been, you know, it's called No Time to Think. It could have actually been called Corned Beef because, no, I swear, because I was eating, we were, I forgot your name.
Who the
Thank
hell
you.
Is
Thank
this
you.
Guy?
I need to look at the cover of the book.
Drugs are just kicking in, folks.
Howard and I, we were eating at Arts and we were talking about the book, and I was chowing down on a corned beef sandwich, and I had said something in passing, like, you know, there's no time to think about things in the news business, and Howard, totally unaware of it, and Howard said, that's a great idea, title for a book, and I said, well, right. What is?
Yeah, yeah, which part?
The ever alert reporter, yeah. And he said, well, no time to think, but it could have been called corned beef, but would you have bought a book called corned beef?
I would have, because I'm a good Irish girl, and corn beef. Patrick's Day,
sure.
Oh my gosh, it's my favorite time of year, because I get corned beef and cabbage.
This book, then, is about not only media, it's about corned beef.
It's about corned beef and stuff.
I'm telling you, you've already sold like 10 copies to me.
And the book is edible, too. You can eat it. It's delicious.
That's right.
Put a little mustard on it. And you can get
a little extra, yeah.
It's a little tough. But, you know.
No, Charles, this was your suggestion, I think, right? Selling it with condoms? Well, I mean, you know, you're trying to sell books.
I admit it.
Excuse me, but boys, are they the flavored condoms?
Okay. Okay.
Now we're getting into an area.
You just went above our pay grade.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so now how long does it take to write a book like this?
It took us close to a year.
A year.
Well, when you talk about writing, there's the researching. And I think the researching even took longer than the writing.
What I would imagine, yes.
Yeah, and it's an exhaustive process. We interviewed probably about 50 people. And, you know, it was a very interesting process.
Yeah.
So is this book objective?
No.
As a matter of fact, no.
No, it isn't.
I mean, there's a strong point of view, right. And you know, we express it very
clearly.
Vividly,
I think.
So you have no doubt. So we don't pretend. I mean, I think we come from it from an objective perspective, but what comes out is a definite point of view, and we don't. I don't take any prisoners when it comes to talking about the people we think that have not served the public well.
Right. But there is a, you know, one of the things that I think we were aware of to a lesser degree going into it, but are now more aware of having the book out there, is that there is a sort of generational issue that comes up, and that is that people who are in their early 20s and are very immersed in the internet, and I am too, I've got my own blog and all that, but I'm not as immersed as some people.
And Susie, Facebook.
Yeah, on Facebook, okay, right.
Yeah, here you go.
But the thing is that very often that generation, your generation, right, you know, become surprisingly defensive about criticisms about how the internet in particular works, which I find really kind of interesting. That if
That's
you point
true.
Out, yeah, if you point out to them that maybe it isn't so good that blogs will put stuff out there before they're verified, and they'll come back at you and they'll say, yeah, but it'll be corrected an hour later by some other blogger, and then my response would be, but isn't it better to check out the information before you put it out there in the first place, as opposed to putting it out and hoping that somebody down the line is going to do that. And they get very defensive about that. Mm. And I find that a really a troubling thing, but I also find that very interesting, and maybe some anthropologist out there who's listening can explain that.
Yeah.
But I don't understand why they're so defensive. It's almost as if, I get the sense, Howard, that there's this feeling among that generation that it's theirs.
Right. Yes,
internet.
Yes.
And they also get very defensive when we attack Happy Meals.
Yeah.
You know, these kids.
I can understand that.
I can. Well, but seriously, and you know, let's talk about where this could ultimately go. You talk about all this stuff, and it sounds sort of minor, but it has a cumulative impact. as I said, one of the things we did was talk to a lot of people, and some of the people we talked to were former press secretaries to presidents, and we asked them, you know, would your job have been different had you worked in this time period? And all of them said, of course, it would have been much different, and several of them said one of the things they worry about is today's leaders will not be able to adjust to the internet. The internet pushes pressure on everybody, on people in the media, on the public, and also our national leaders to act much faster, and there's danger in that kind of a speed. Mm. One of the people we talked to was Ted Sorensen. Ted Sorensen was a confidant of President Kennedy, very close confidant, and it was in the negotiations of something called the Cuban missile crisis. Mm-hmm. For your listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Like Susie. She's taking history.
These 13 days in 1962, when the world was very, very close, right on the brink of nuclear disaster, what had happened was the U.S. had detected Soviet missile bases being built. In fact, they were built already on the shores of Cuba, 90 miles away. What were we going to do about that? They could be, you know, be aimed at the U.S., it could be a total disaster. And there was this period of very delicate negotiations which had to be done in secret, where they didn't want the public to know because they feared the public would panic, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What should they do? The Joint Chiefs of Staff, the President's military advisors, wanted immediately to take out the missiles. Would that have been the smart thing to do? Maybe not. Anyway, so Sorensen talked to us about this, and we asked him what he thought would have happened had the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred in this frenzied media climate. And his reply was immediate. He said, we probably wouldn't even be here to talking about it.
Wow.
So Charles and I talked about that, and we said, boy, that's really a doomsday scenario. Is that really what he meant? So we got back to him and asked him, is that really what you meant to say? And man, he went right down the line, step by step by step by step, would have happened. Ultimately, we would have gone on the first option, which was to take out the nuclear bases,
right.
And the Soviets would have immediately responded. And his last three words were really chilling: destruction of the world.
Wow.
Okay. Now,
yeah.
I just got chills like all over.
Yeah.
Yes,
but
yes,
you're right. So what
right.
you're saying is people,
and he's not even hot.
But you're saying that things would have gone a lot faster.
Yeah.
If it happened now, and people wouldn't take the time to really think, is this the right thing?
Yeah.
To do?
And listen, this is speculation. No bones about it. But simply, it's very informed speculation. And this guy, even though he's like probably in his early 80s now, is very sharp and not at all given to hyperbole. So I think his words are something to heed.
Yeah.
So what the internet does in particular, I think, is it takes what used to be sort of neighborhood rumor, you know, a bunch of people sitting around, maybe in, you know, New York, they'd be sitting on a stoop somewhere. Mm-hmm. They don't have stoops in L.A. Wherever they sit in L.A., I don't know.
In their car.
You know, on the beach or whatever. But you know, what used to be just sort of, you know, people sort of talking about things, and one person would say, well, what do you think about this? And the other person would say, what do you think about that? Now, all that stuff is out there in the internet, and you see this sort of these dueling opinions, mm-hmm. Depending on what blog you're reading. I mean, look at this whole thing going on ad nauseum between whether or not, you know, Hillary Clinton is or isn't going to be Obama's Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Just this morning alone, I was looking in the internet. One blog said she's been made the offer. Another blog said she hasn't been made the offer, but she might be made the offer.
Right.
And another blog said she's made the offer, but she may not take the offer.
Right.
And all of this is just uninformed speculation, but depending on what blog you're reading at the moment, you come away with a different impression of what's
going on. That's true. That's absolutely true, you know. And then you have all these places that we get the news from, and like Wikipedia, for example.
I was thinking about that, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I call it wicked.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's been a few books written on this, of how dangerous that is, because we come to rely on everything that's written, and yet this is written by, like, people like you and me. I mean, it could be like a 12-year-old.
And you can change it as you go along.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
That's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, if people know that in advance, then that's one thing, you know. But I think most people don't realize that.
Well, and you know, even if you do, and I can tell you I do, I can still tell you it's incredibly seductive. Mm. It is such an easy place to go if you want instant information.
Right. I was there last night for a couple of different things.
Yeah.
Well, and what happens?
Don't even tell us what it was.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get an electric Mini Cooper for the trial.
Okay. We'll explore that later. An electric the trial. Okay. No, but you know, but on Wikipedia, I taught for a few semesters at USC, where Howard still teaches some classes. Mm-hmm. And what I was very troubled by was when I would have students write papers for me, which were supposed to be journalistic papers about a particular topic, they'd hand it in and I would...
Source Wikipedia.
Yeah, and I'd say, where'd you get this from? And they'd say, well, I got it from Wikipedia. And I'd say, well, how do you know it's true? And they'd say, well, you know, we Googled whatever the topic is and Wikipedia came first. And Wikipedia comes up first because the way search engines work, and most people don't know how they work, including me, but the way they do work, Wikipedia manages to come up pretty much at the very top of almost anything you Google.
Yeah, they have a high page rank.
They have a high page ranking, yes. Right, yeah. So what happens is if you Google, you know, Barack Obama, you have pretty good odds that Wikipedia is going to come
up. That's true.
And a lot of these students took it at face value that what they were reading on Wikipedia was true. And I've known a number of people who, because of who they are, happen to have entries about themselves in Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've never met one of them who had it that was accurate. Yeah. They always had things that were not accurate about it.
Wow.
And that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it really is, you know, because, like, you're right. I mean, he might have some conflict of interest in what he's writing, and we don't know that.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, this is like, so let's go to the most recent elections, for example, right? I mean, that's one thing that bothers me is they always try to predict everything, you know, and like happened before, you know, I mean, what was it, the last election where they declared, or the first one, where we declared one guy won, and then, you know, the next morning it was a different president.
You're talking about...
The illegitimate
Truman.
Presidency
yes,
of George
exactly,
Bush.
Yes, exactly, the 2000 one, yeah.
No, but you're talking about Truman and Dewey, is it?
I was talking about Truman. I was talking about Bush and Gore, but Dewey and Truman was the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Already then they were doing
this. But you know, this is really interesting because one of the things we haven't talked about, we do talk about in the book, and Charles has been through it because he was part of it, was this whole idea of what they call feeding the bees. In other words, you know, the cable news channels have this enormous news holes. You cannot possibly fill them with news, okay? So what do? You know, they fill it with everything else. I mean, the definition of news used to be anything that's new. Now it's just anything.
Right,
anything they
come
across goes out there. It's called feeding the beast, and the beast is always ravenous. And one way you feed the beast is you think of a way to make news even faster than live. How can you make news faster than live? It's impossible, right?
Yeah.
You predict news before it happens.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's really scary.
You report
scary,
it
huh?
before it happens. How do you report it before it happens? You predict the news.
You predict.
And you find all over cable news channels, to some extent the internet, but largely cable news channels, that are predicting all the time. I mean, whether it's 2 days before something happens, or it's an hour before something, or it's 2 minutes before something, somebody could be holding a press conference, and they're in there with their panels of people predicting, what do you think he's going to say? What do you think he's going to say? Or the debates. What do you think is going to happen? Right. All you have to do is wait a couple of minutes.
And there's enormous...
That is exactly what goes on. That's so scary. Yeah.
And there's enormous amount of pressure on reporters who work for these organizations to get out with fresh information all the time. And sometimes it reaches a ridiculous extreme. And an example of that was a few years back when I was still working at CNN out here. Kobe Bryant got into trouble,
mm-hmm.
which is
right.
being euphemistic, but right. he got into, to put it mildly, and it wasn't because of shooting a hoop. maybe it was.
He went one-on-one and didn't work out.
But I'm one-on-one. He was arrested, right? And so this was in the middle of the night now, and I got a phone call waking me up saying, you know, rush down to Staples Center. Now, this is like 2 a.m. Because we need a backdrop. That's where he would normally play, and we want you to tell the Kobe Bryant story, whatever we know at the moment.
Right.
I said, "Oh, okay, it's kind of stupid, but all right, you know." So I get dressed and I go running down in the middle of the night to the Staples Center, and I'm doing the report live. But of course, the anchors want to get to the next thing. They want to constantly get fresh information. So I finished my report about what we knew at the time was happening, and the anchor, I throw it back to the anchor, and the anchor says to me, "Well, Charles, tell me, what's the reaction to this to people on the street now?" And I said, it's 3 a.m. There is nobody on the street. I'm the only one here. But there was the desire to constantly get something new. It wasn't good enough that I was talking about what had happened only minutes ago with his arrest. Right. Now they wanted to know, what's the next step? What does the public think about what happened? But at 3 a.m. in the morning, the public didn't even know about it.
Wow. And you know, I mean, this brings us to the fact that the news reporters influence the news, right? I mean, the thing is this, is that if I'm a voter and I haven't voted by 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I find out that this candidate is leading, I'm not going to go and vote anymore, you know? So I think that speed really influences what we do.
Well, in California, for example, there didn't seem to be any doubt, okay, that Obama would carry this state.
Right.
But if you were inclined to vote only in the presidential election and you saw what was happening, maybe you would not bother to go to the polls and vote in the other propositions, for example, you know, and that could be very problematic. And again, there is this, you know, and to be honest, I mean, you know, they're in a pickle, 24-hour news and et cetera, all the other networks, because if you have information, I mean, the idea of being in news is you have information and you report it if you feel like it's valid information. Right. But at the same time, you have to weigh that against what's really right for the public.
When you said pickle, I thought you were getting back to the Happy Meal.
He loves Happy Meals.
I love those Happy Meals.
I thought we were going. Are we going to Art's Deli afterwards?
Yeah. Oh, I would love that. I'm hungry now.
There's a lot of food in this.
So, did you have to meet often at the deli? Is that where you really wrote the book?
Or? We put on a lot of weight too. We were like anorexic when we started writing this book.
We're all on SlimFest.
No. You sit down, it's like writing a you know, playing a duet at the piano. Right. You sit down in front of a computer, he writes one line, I write one line, he writes another line. And somehow it works out.
Is that the way really it's written? Because I was going to ask you about it. When there's two people or three people writing a book, I wonder how that happens. I mean, each one writes a certain portion, right?
And it is awkward. I mean, and it's something you have to get used to. We finally worked it out because, you know, we each write well, but we have different writing styles, and so you have to somehow merge.
How do you blend?
But
you end up with this sort of hybrid. You end up with something that isn't entirely the way he normally writes, and it isn't entirely the way I normally write.
But the misspellings are all Charles.
Yes, and all the typos are
I have nothing
are
to do with those.
But hey, then you reach an even broader audience. You know, you bring all of your people and all of your
people.
Well,
exactly. It's like a merger.
I didn't mean Jewish people.
No, no, no. Back to that again.
Mostly Jews, though.
Yeah. All the Jews. We sound like a law firm, yes. Rosenberg and Feldman.
Actually, you do. You guys sound like a...
Or a vaudeville team or something.
Rosenberg, Feldman, and Shamil.
One of the bad commercials for, like, have you been in an accident?
Yes, that's right.
Rosenberg and Feldman.
But, you know, I mean, we're having fun here and joking about it. But it's really a serious topic because, you know, the media, in some ways, are in dire straits today. I mean, everything, the whole character is changing. As we all know, newspapers are, you know, slower going sort of down into the toilet, and they're having a terrible time. They're adapting more and more to the internet, reassigning more of their resource to the internet in hopes of surviving that way, even though they have not found an economic model that will allow them to make profits that will make up for everything they've lost on the printed page.
Yeah.
But that's changing, and even television itself, I mean, increasingly is more blog-like. I mean, you'll hear people on television, on the cable news channel, talking about that there will be blogging on the internet as soon as they get off the air. Mm. Or sometimes all this happens simultaneously. Did you watch the presidential debates?
Yes. Mm.
Did you watch it on CNN?
Wherever. I don't remember, probably.
High comedy.
I listened to it on the radio, actually.
Okay, high comedy. On CNN, I mean, this is sort of classic and multitasking. Not only were you watching the debate, okay, they also had this focus group in Ohio, which they had them sort of tied up to electrodes or something. And they were using these little devices in which as each side, whether it was Obama or McCain, was speaking, the people would give you their immediate reactions, instant by instant, word wow. by word what they were saying, and it came out as sort of a squiggly graph line beneath the screen. It would go up, it would go down, it would go up, and it would go down. And I would suggest to you, this is totally...
This is so disturbing.
It's not only disturbing, it's meaningless. Yeah. It has no meaning whatsoever. Again, yeah. it's people just reacting instantly, not thinking about their responses. Right. But it's another example how they're into this instant reaction mode,
right.
and which I find sort of dangerous. And it also, you know, diverted your attention from what the guys were saying.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't you say, though, that this is probably all emanating from the fact that we do have shorter attention spans now, because everything moves faster in our lives. It's not just the news. It's not just the media. Everything, you know, or the internet. The internet simply, I think, just epitomizes our life outside cyberspace, you know? You know, people doing like a million things, you know, mother's taking the kids, doing this, and people working long hours and commuting and all that. We don't have time to really take the time and sit and read the paper. You know, where we used
sure.
to, you know,
and
I mean,
that,
I
and
love
that is
reading
why
the paper.
Media is trying to get news out like as quickly as possible, because
sure.
like I said before, you know, I only have a few minutes each day,
of course.
You know, to turn on the TV and like check out what's going on. And I mean, I literally have 5 to 10 minutes to like see, okay, these are the points of what's
sure.
going on in the world.
Traditional newspaper readers are dying out. There's no question.
Yeah,
it's an older
yeah.
and older audience. And that's exactly why newspapers are trying, always not so successfully, but trying to adapt. And, you know, there are pitfalls there, too. One of the things we did in the book was profile a small paper outside of Los Angeles, the Ventura County Star.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it's a newspaper with a circulation of about 80,000. And we profiled it as a way of using it as a microcosm of what's happening nationwide with much bigger papers. And one of the things we did was profile a young reporter, a young guy, 22, 23, mm-hmm. really smart young kid. And we followed him around as he covered a crime story. Now, in the old days, when you come into the office and you're assigned to do police stories and you get an assignment, the first thing you do is you go out, you pick up your notebook and you run out and cover it.
Mm-hmm.
Now what this kid does, he picks up his notebook and the second thing he does, he opens a file drawer, takes out a video camera, and then goes out, because not only is he required to write for the paper, he's also required to file stories continually for the internet. Shoot tape that goes on the internet and
uh-huh.
file continual updates. And this again goes back to what you're talking about, multitasking.
Right.
The media have to do it yourself. And Charles and I would argue that when this happens, there's an even greater chance that not only will you make mistakes, but that the quality of your work will suffer,
right.
because you're not giving really a lot of attention to anything you're doing.
And there's something else that's happening, which is happening in conjunction with this increase of speed and the movement of news from newspapers and television to the internet, which is what makes it a really serious problem. And that is, if you were just transferring all of these experienced journalists from the print medium to the internet, that in and of itself might not be so bad. I mean, you know, things change. You know, there was a time when people used to write on, what was it, papyrus. Papyrus, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody walks around with that now,
yeah.
you know. I mean, you know, a few people. But I have a big library there. But you know, the vehicle of transmission of information does change. And sure, why not? But what's happening in addition is, because of economic reasons, you're also losing the experienced people who are working at these newspapers.
Mm.
So when you turn on, you know, when you look, because you don't have time, and you look at the web for mm-hmm. your, you know, quick news headlines, the problem is that not only are you getting the news faster, you are probably also, and increasingly as the future goes on, getting it written by people who don't have all that much experience, because
mm-hmm.
they're cheaper, they're new hires, and they are just... for that medium, you know, they're better employees.
Right.
So what's the answer? There's no hope.
A happy meal.
There you go. The happy meal and the hot news guy.
No, I mean, it's not that there's no hope, but it puts an increasing burden on the public. I mean, we are just going to have to be smarter and smarter.
Right.
And just be more sophisticated about making media choices and having much more critical awareness. I mean, you know, I've always... and I'm sure you have too, advocated that people be basically skeptical about media. Not everything you come across is going to be the truth. During this campaign. I can't tell you the number of times I got stuff from my fellow liberal Democrats. I'm a liberal Democrat. I have a great dislike for Sarah Palin. But I can tell you, I kept getting stuff on the internet saying things about Sarah Palin that were patently false. Mm. Okay, the people believed because they were, one, I got, a friend of mine sent me a picture, okay, it was Sarah Palin in this very revealing bikini with an Uzi.
It was very hot.
And she
was pretty hot.
Very hot. And in high D. In high D.
In high D, yeah.
But the inscription was,
and
see.
And you didn't vote for them?
Right. But the inscription was, see, look, wouldn't you know it? It was a phony picture. Her head had been
don't
superimposed.
Don't you know he?
Okay. Yeah. And what amazes me, though, is let's talk about USA Today for a moment, because sure. I think they were way ahead of their time, because they sort of predicted how we would be now. And started giving you like small bits of
news.
Well,
it was a newspaper. It was a newspaper, really created to emulate television.
Right, exactly. I mean, even their dispensers looked like television sets.
Exactly,
right?
Looked like TV
sets.
And
I remember when it came out, it was probably like 25 years ago, I think, in the early 80s. USA Today came out, and it was highly criticized. They were the first newspaper that had color, yes. And but they only give you snippets of the news. There was nothing in depth, you know.
Right.
So of course, all the major newspapers would try to put them down and all that stuff. But the thing is, they've become a force to reckon with now,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And I think it is an easier way to consume the news. It may not be the deepest, but I mean, they
but you know,
survived.
Yeah, but you know, there's a sad thing about the USA thing, and that is that one of the reasons why other newspapers started copying them was that they looked at what was the apparent success of USA Today in terms of circulation, and they thought, well, you know, if USA is getting all these readers, then we should do the same thing. The problem with that is it's actually a specious argument, because if you look at the breakdown of USA Today's distribution, most of it, or a lot of it anyway, is really not paid distribution. They're not people picking it up at a newsstand or subscribing to it. They were very smart in the beginning, and they were among the first papers to make sure that they were distributed at hotels
and
hotels
for free.
And that was not done. You know, now it's kind of routine to get a paper at your door, but it wasn't when USA Today came out. And one of the things that they were very smart about was to make sure that they were distributed for free to in all these venues. And so a lot of their so-called big circulation is actually what I call forced circulation.
I see.
I mean, you know, you get up in the morning, it's in front of your door.
You're going to open it and read it.
But that doesn't, it's not the same thing as going down and buying it. And I think that what happened is that a lot of newspapers panicked early on, and they looked at those numbers. They failed to analyze those numbers the way they ought to have. And they said, my God, USA Today is getting all these readers. They must be doing something right. So we need to have color maps, and we need to have shorter stories, and we need to do this and that. But that really wasn't the case. It was a phony inflated figure, and it's still a phony inflated figure.
Is it really? Wow, that's amazing.
But it is an easy way to read the news. No question about it. But the problem, it's not the color coded stuff that bothers me.
Right.
It is a lack of depth, and it's always been that way.
Right.
You know?
Right. But if you just want to call sort of like the headlines and stuff, you know, then it's a good way, I think. But I used to love it because of the novelty when it first came out, and then I realized, you know, it doesn't have enough local news, you know, and newspapers are often, you know, for the local appeal that they have, you know.
Right.
So, this is like so exciting to have you guys here, like so deep, you know, we could sit here for hours and talk about this. So, what's next for you? I mean, you're retired already, right?
No.
But you still write?
Well, yeah, I mean, we...
You retired from the LA Times.
Retired from the LA Times, and I teach at USC, and I teach a couple classes there. And
what kind of classes do you take or teach?
I teach a class on news ethics, and also a big TV symposium, and also I teach critical writing.
Oh, cool.
So I'm pretty busy doing that.
Nice. And you've been a writer all your life, pretty much?
Pretty much so, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, just what you know, if you are one, that's what you do all the time. this has been a real good learning experience for both Charles and me, because I mean, we've learned the one thing. It's one thing to write the book.
Right.
And it's another effort to go around and talk about it afterward, which is really part of the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't think about it.
Yeah, and you think about it more as you go along and you talk about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. And Charles, what about you?
I'm thinking of learning brain surgery.
Yeah. Always, that's a good time.
I've always wanted to do brain surgery, and I figured, if not now, when?
Yeah.
I mean, there you go. If not now, when?
Yeah, I'll be your first patient.
Okay.
My sister can help you. She's a surgeon.
Oh, okay. There's a firm right there for you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Two so, Jewish doctors and a doctor from Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
There you go. I do some media consulting, and I still actually have one foot in the news door. I do some stuff here at KNX.
CBS
News Radio. Nice.
You can hear them all the time on KNX Radio.
Yeah, you know, really? where I do the exact same thing that we deride in our book, which is give very little thought to pieces that go on the air very quickly, which is sort of the formula. Yeah. So I do that, and we have the book. And, you know, the interesting thing is that now we have the book. A lot of people, when we've gone to sell the book at bookstores or whatever, a lot of times people will come up and they'll say, so what's your next book? And I haven't even thought about that. Yeah. But I guess now that I'm an author, I should have a next book.
You should. We'll make yeah.
I should have
we'll
a next
just
book.
Just make one up, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it, so does, you'll seem like you know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
Does No Time to Think come with a bookmark?
That's right.
Yeah, Tom Brokaw.
Well, I like your thinking.
I was thinking of maybe bookmarks with members of, you know, former members of the Bush administration.
There you go. Now that would be
wouldn't
appropriate.
Wouldn't that be
interesting? Yeah, and I like to see their heads lopped off on you.
For sure. For sure.
One more thing. Why don't you go ahead? You probably have websites, right? Do you want to go ahead and
yes,
let people know?
Yes, it's www.notimetothinkbook.com.
Okay.
That's the book's website. And,
right. And then you have your own, right? Howard Rosenberg?
I do have one, but I haven't been updating that one. This is the one we've really been working on, and okay. there are links to everything. I mean, we just did an op-ed piece for Forbes.com. That's there. Any of our appearances are there. Last night we did a book signing in the Palisades,
and I have a blog called the Feldmanblog.com, mm-hmm. which is sort of commentary and satire.
Nice.
All I really care about is if people click on the Google ads.
Right.
and I write a weekly thing. I'll get a plug in for a friend. I write a weekly of all things real estate related column for something called BiggerPockets.com, which uh-huh. is a real estate a website, a very good one. So I do that, and I got that plug in. So there we go.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. And this was great fun.
Yes, and I told you it would be, you know. And the first time, it's sort of like nobody knew where to go or, you know, but you were kind enough, Howard, to send me an email, apologize, and I was really touched, you know. I was really touched. And but
you should have heard what we said about you when you didn't show up last
time. Yeah, but we should say it. I mean, what happened was...
You know, we had no time to think.
We blew... No. Yeah, that's true. No, we blew it. Well, we were in New York. No, we were supposed to be here last week.
Two weeks ago.
And we were in New York, you know, selling the book, and you know, between going back and forth and time zone shifts and all that, we dropped the ball. And mm-hmm. you know.
But I've mentioned you, okay, I just have to tell you about New York because we've been doing radio shows, and we did one in New York on WOR, the Joey Reynolds Show. You know Joey Reynolds? Okay.
Yeah.
It's really a kick, so we go in there. It's 1 in the morning. You know, we become whores. Whatever, just call us. We'll get out of bed and our pajamas.
We'll be there.
We're there. And we're there. We walk in, you know, we're there at 1 o'clock, and you know, for the first 20 minutes, he does a monologue. Mm-hmm. He's doing a monologue with us as the audience, and plus he has a sidekick, a different kind of, you know, your equal side. This guy's name is Cha-Cha. And he comes in eating a big chicken sandwich. Charles is sitting next to him. He's slobbering food all over Charles.
Oh, no.
So this was very refreshing.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, so Mr. Charles Feldman, thank you very much. I wanted to talk to you all about the Robert Blake thing and everything. Oh, I know you covered that.
Yes, yeah.
But maybe we'll leave it for another time. You know, okay. Maybe you can call in or something, you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about it.
Happy to do that.
I just learned who Robert Blake was earlier.
Yeah, she didn't know. Yeah. You see, it's a learning experience for her here, you know. And Howard Rosenberg, thank you so much.
Pleasure,
you know, all the best
pleasure.
To you.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck with the book. It's No Time to Think, of course. Howard Rosenberg and Charles Feldman. I'm sure you can get it everywhere.
Yes.
And again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
pick up the book for Christmas or Hanukkah.
Yeah,
whatever.
Or whatever.
And if you're too lazy to go to a bookstore, there's like Amazon.
Ramadan, anything.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know,
but your next book you should title definitely Three Jews and a Shiksa.
Sure,
you know, that would work very well.
We'll give it consideration.
Yeah. Okay, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Susie, have a great time tonight. She's going to a Penthouse magazine party.
Oh.
So,
boy, you really know how to pick them. Huh?
She
thank
really
you.
Does.
Thank you.
She really does. And she's going to tell us all about it on Monday. So thank you all for joining us. And we'll be right here, right now on same
right,
time.
Yeah, Monday.
No, not right now. Okay, we're leaving. But we'll be here Monday.